they're required to do, you know, two tests, an in-flight test, which they pretty much took care of a few years ago. Boeing did. NASA's happy with the testing that they've done so far on that. But then there's a ground test. In other words, if you have a spacecraft sitting on top of a booster on a launch pad right before launch, and something goes wrong, will the spacecraft be able to take off and get away from the booster in time? Okay, I have an ID going on the Zeldin machine here. So what they need to do is to test to make sure this could work. So they're going to do this out in New Mexico, White Sands, New Mexico. They have a launch pad out there that they're putting the Starliner vehicle on, same one that you would use to put people in. And they're attaching it to a mock-up booster. The same connector is being used that would be normally attached to the Atlas V rocket. Starliner will be going into space on an Atlas V rocket. They have it attached to this platform out in the middle of New Mexico. And they plan on lighting off these four engines that are going to drive it away at 9 o'clock tomorrow Eastern. It should be pretty interesting. Yeah, you know, you'll see the four engines will ignite in the what looks like the service module, you know, the bottom part of the rocket, and we'll fly away from the make-believe booster, and it will fly about a mile high and about a mile away from where it started, and on the way up, it's going to eventually control its maneuvering the idea is to make the back end of the vehicle start to come down first, so that parachutes will be able to open up. So to do that, they have a combination of 64 rocket motors on this vehicle. You know, smaller ones. You have the four big ones, and then 30 some odd other ones, medium size, and more smaller ones for attitude control. So those rockets will come on and will pitch around in a certain direction where the back end is coming in first. And the front will be able to open up, and parachutes will start to deploy. And they have a series of drogue parachutes, and they pull out eventually bigger parachutes. And once that happens, the service module, you'll see that separate, and then that will expose the heat shield. Actually, you're not really going to need that because you're not coming down that very, you know, that fast. But you'll be coming down toward the ground in New Mexico. And then as you get about a mile, or a little less than a mile above the ground, the heat shield will have to separate, so you'll see that fall off. And then you'll see that followed by six gigantic airbags that are going to expand on the bottom of the vehicle. And the airbags are there to soften the landing, whether it lands on land, in this case land, or in the real world, it will be launched from Florida, you know, Launch Complex 41, and eventually it would land in water. But in this case, it's going to land on land, and which is, of course, another good test because the Starliners will be flown to the space station and back. They're all reusable, but on their return trips, they'll probably land in Utah or maybe even New Mexico. They have five possible landing locations, all on land, which of course the scientists like, because the second it lands on land, they'll come out with an army of support vehicles and, you know, helicopters, and they'll be able to get the crew out quick. But as far as the scientists are happy, because sometimes they'll be bringing back science experiments that they need to bring back to their labs. If they land in the water, that time is really delayed. And time is everything when it comes to these certain refrigerated products that have to be usually kept cold. So looking forward to see that. Bring up NASA.gov, and they'll direct you to click on NASA TV where you'll get that. It should be pretty good. It's very important, of course, if there really is a problem, to get these astronauts away from the vehicle if that happens. And if that gets approved by NASA, they'll be good to go early next year. So, and then the following day, I believe SpaceX has a test in Florida. They would like to test the Draco engines that blew up back in April that destroyed their spacecraft. They're going to run another test on that, make sure the Draco engines work for SpaceX. These powerful engines that Starliner is using, this is the four that are going to be pushing it away. You get roughly around 160 pounds of thrust, you know, if you add up the thrust on those four engines. And it's very similar to SpaceX with these Super Draco engines. And we'll have to see how that turns out. Because if that works out okay, then SpaceX has to do an inline, in-flight test. And that'll be a little bit more dramatic, and that would take place probably within about another month or so from Florida. They would launch a Falcon 9 rocket with the spacecraft on top, probably from Launch Complex 39A, and that would go roughly around 1,300 miles an hour before the spacecraft separates from the booster in a make-believe disaster. And they're going to see if that thing can get away properly and eventually land on the water. So it's weird. You got two companies going to the space station with crews in a couple of months. And they both need tests, but they need opposite tests. You know, Boeing's already got approved for in-flight tests for aboard, but not the ground abort test. And with SpaceX, it's the other way around. They got an approval for their ground test back in 2015, but not the in-flight test. So hopefully this all works out, because we really need to get astronauts launched from American soil again. And I'd like to see that since 2011. That hasn't happened. Okay, so any questions on that before I go on to the next topic? Okay, like Dick was saying before, Roy's going to post a picture for me on his website. And this has to do with the Cygnus cargo vehicles resupplying supplies to the International Space Station. The Cygnus, in this case, is carrying 8,200 pounds worth of supplies, science instruments, food, tools that are going to be needed to the space station. It's the most that this Cygnus has been able to carry. When they started years ago doing this, that 12th trip to the space station, they started off with like 4,000 pounds and then worked their way up to 6,000 pounds. And eventually, they started launching a couple of launches on an Atlas V rocket, because their Antares rocket was down for a period of time because one had blown up. And Atlas V was able to carry up to almost 7,000 pounds. But now they're up to they don't use the Atlas anymore. They went back to the Antares rocket, and they were able to carry over 8,000 pounds of cargo to the space station, which is a lot. And Cygnus is flown by the Antares rocket. This company used to be called Orbital ATK. Orbital ATK has now been bought up by Northrop Grumman. So they changed the letters, and but the numbers are the same. It's a 12 flight, so they're calling it NG Northrop Grumman 12, so it's the NG flight. And they named it after Alan Beam. Alan Beam is the fourth astronaut to have a walk on the moon, and he just died recently. So, you know, if you die they have a tradition of naming the different vehicles after people that have passed, but astronauts that have flown in space. So it got off on time on a Saturday morning. I mentioned this last week that it was going to be going up, and anytime they launch an Antares Cygnus rocket, it launches from Virginia, a place called Wallops Island, Virginia. So naturally, it's down by the ocean, and if they do that, there's certain areas in the East Coast, including us here on Long Island, and even in the city, that, you know, if you're looking in a certain direction and you have a clear view, in our case, it's south or just, you know, southwest. If you have a clear view in the horizon, you know, because the vehicle that we see it go up, if we're going to try to see it, only goes up to about 15 degrees, and that's it for Long Island. If you're in closer, you know, you get a much higher elevation that you can see it. But from here, it's 16 degrees, and it's roughly 150 seconds later. So it's like a little over 2 minutes later. You know, if you're looking at that certain location, sure enough, you'll be able to see the engines and this long trail of white smoke. So to make sure, I wanted to try this Saturday morning. So to make sure, I took an old one second. I went outside and checked the angle. I made sure I had 15 degrees. I knew beforehand that if I went out like by my mailbox in the street, and I looked in a certain direction where the signal was supposed to be going from, I should be able to see, because there was like there's trees there, but between the trees it does go below 15 degrees. So sure enough, the launch took off on time at 9:59, 1 minute before 10. And sure enough, roughly 2.5 minutes later, now I'm looking at my tablet. If you put on NASA TV, you know, you could see what you're looking at. So sure enough, exactly at the right time, I looked in that one area, and there it was. You know, I mean, it was a beautiful blue sky out. There wasn't a cloud in the sky. And took my cell phone and was able to take a picture of this thing. Actually, I took a bunch of pictures, but only one came out. Sure enough, when I got in, I was able to look at it, figured out how to crop it. Too much. It's far away, and I don't have a zoom lens on this this phone. So I understand some of the new phones, like the iPhones, are coming out with basically three different lenses you could use so you could zoom in on something like this. I don't have that capability, but I did a 13 megapixel camera, which isn't bad, because considering that the Hubble has a 5 megapixel camera, I figured it should be okay. Sure enough, came out, and if you zoom in on it, sure enough, you can see it. So I cropped it, marked it with a red arrow, you know, so you're pointing to what you're going to see. And what you do is you zoom in on the picture itself, on the trees, and eventually you'll see the red arrow. And then once you do that, then you can zoom in a little bit better, get a better idea where it is. And sure enough, you can clearly see this the exhaust from the two RD 181 engines. They're actually Russian built engines. This is WS2N, and sure enough, you can see these engines and the exhaust coming out. And I mean, within seconds, this thing lasted, 15 seconds or so, and then it was gone. I mean, just disappeared. Because what it's doing, it's actually going southeast. It's chasing the space station. Naturally, the rocket doesn't come over land. It goes over the water, goes over the ocean, and leaves Virginia, going in a south-easterly direction. So it's going up, and that's why we get to 15 degrees, but then it starts going over the horizon, and it's gone. So what I did is I sent it over to Doc Roy, and he says he's going to put it onto the website. Seldon repeat his ID, and they have the right time. That's good. They're not an hour off. I remember years ago, they were always an hour off. It was a tough time to be on the net. You know, you wouldn't know if the net was going to be cut off early or late. But it looks like Lou is doing good with all the settings. So that's the story on that. You could view that if you like. They had a lot of science go up on that mission, so they have like this one astrovest, they call it, where you're an astronaut, you can put this astrovest on, and it's going to protect you from all the different radiation. So, for instance, if they know a radiation blast is coming their way, from advanced warning, let's say from the Discover satellite that's a million miles out toward the sun, and they know this is coming their way, they'd be able to put these, they call it astro-rad vest on it, possibly shield themselves from higher radiation levels. They have a couple of them up there that they sent, and they have different sizes, so you could fit a big guy, women could wear it, or a small guy could wear it, and that type of thing. So they have that. All kinds of CubeSats are going up there as well to eventually be launched from inside the space station, and the Cygnus will stay docked to the space station for a couple of months. And then they'll load it up with all kinds of trash and things that eventually to be destroyed. So while it's connected, they have this setup inside. The astronauts go inside, and they have this driving setup that went up on a space station. They're going to be able to interface with a robot on the ground. Or actually a rover on the ground with an arm on it. It's going to have a drill on it. And they want to be able to see how astronauts operate a rover remotely from space. They're going to try to check their skills and their ability on doing this. And there's a goal for that. Eventually, you're going to have astronauts going around the moon in another type of space station called Gateway, and some of the equipment that they're going to be using will be on the moon, and they'll be operating it remotely from the Gateway space station. But to do that, they need to practice, and that's one of the things they're going to do. Another thing that they brought up, I actually heard this on the news, was a stove. They bought a stove up that could go up to almost 700 degrees Fahrenheit, 600 plus. So you'll be able to put like cookie dough in there and make your own cookies if you want. And, they have improved food. It's not like the years ago with John Glenn, where they were, squeezing food out of tubes. They have a microwave up there and everything. But they have this oven where they're going to be able to cook things in zero G. And they'll test to see how that works out. As we can mention, one of the items is going to be a recycler. So it's a machine that looks like the size of a good size microwave oven, and you'll be able to put plastics in there. Dissolve everything, and it'll create, a filament for eventually making other products from from this 3D machine that they have on board now. And this recycling machine is made by the same company, Made in Space. Is the company that makes it, Made in Space. So have that, and I think 29 different tools have gone up, and equipment to repair the alpha magnetic spectrometer outboard on the space station. This is a big, I call it a telescope. It's really not a telescope, but it is a detector of sorts that could detect protons or electrons flying through space. And it went up in one of the last space shuttle missions, so I think it's been up there like since 2011. And it was supposed to last for 2 years, and it just kept on going. And things have failed. It's got multiple pumps on board, for instance, to keep this detector cold. It's an actual refrigeration type system that pumps carbon dioxide. So four pumps. Three have failed, and then the last one is working now, but intermittently. So they're going to replace all of that, and the whole system and everything that's involved with this cooling setup wasn't ever made to be serviced. Comment. Very good. Go ahead. Back to you.
You both have to stop. The world is flat. We never went to the moon. Please, give me a break.
I know. I don't have time to discuss that. I guess that's philosophy. The philosophy net, I think that starts at 12:05, right? Sometimes they alternate between the political net and that one. It's like, I can't help you on that. As far as these tools that they brought up, they're going to use them to repair this machine, and this machine would work whether or not it was on a space station or free flying, but they have it attached to the space station because they don't need to have solar panels. They have solar panels from the space station, so this thing needs a tremendous amount of energy. So it gets supplied by the space station. That's all working fine, but these pumps have all failed, and they have these very small 1/8-inch and 1/4-inch lines that have to be cut and somehow repaired in space and been pressure tested and then eventually recharged with carbon dioxide. And they plan on doing around 4, maybe 5 spacewalks to do this over time. So they have a couple other spacewalks they have to get out of the way. They still never finished the lithium-ion batteries that they were doing. They still have to put 3 more of them in and remove 6 old ones, 6 old nickel-hydrogen batteries. So once they get that done, they'll be able to work on the alpha magnetic spectrometer. Any other comments or questions? This is WS2N. Okay, an update on the InSight mission. InSight mission is sitting on planet Mars right now. And that's been up there since the beginning of the year. And for 8 months now, they've been trying to drill this hole 15 feet deep into the Mars surface. And it's not been going well. They got the mole down only about halfway into halfway of its length. It's a 14-inch long mole, and they got it in, and it stopped. And they thought they had a rock, and they said, "Well, maybe it has to do with the soil. We'll use the robotic arm to push the soil down next to it to try to increase the tension, because the soil might be too soft and fluffy." And that seemed to work. It went down. It was almost gone, and all of a sudden, it started to pop out again, and it wound up
coming almost all the way out of the surface. So they're trying to work on that problem. They seem to think that they can still do this. They've got some other ideas, but right now it doesn't look good. But the engineers in Germany that are behind this particular instrument are brainstorming to see if they can get this thing to drill down all the way into the surface. They can't take it all the way out with the robotic arm. It was never meant to do that. So, if it comes too far out and falls to the side, I think it's over. But they're still getting a lot of other science from the InSight mission. The seismometer system is working very good. That's the one where they put six seismometers. It's all in one unit. And they put it on the surface of Mars, and they are able to detect what they believe are Martian quakes, instead of earthquakes, or maybe even meteors hitting the surface of Mars. It's so sensitive it could detect that. It could detect movement, they said, less than the diameter of a proton. It's so sensitive to one of these pieces of equipment that are just working amazingly up until now. So they're getting good science out of that and a couple of the other science experiments as well that they put on this InSight mission. So hopefully InSight will have some company next year when another Mars rover, Mars Curiosity, goes, flies up there. And that thing is going well. Everything has been tested. They've got the wheels on, pretty much ready to go. They've tested the heat shields. They've tested the sky crane, they call it. That's this pack of motor engines that fly above the rover. And then come down near the surface, and it lowers the rover on cables until eventually the wheels touch the surface, and then this pyrotechnics that go off that cut the cables, and this sky crane flies away. Similar setup, except more advanced than what Mars Curiosity did. It's called Mars 2020 rover. Not to be outdone, European Space Agency is sending their own rover. They're launching it actually on a Proton Russian rocket, and they want to be able to do that right around the same time that we're doing our rover. The difference is they have solar panels. It's going to be similar to what Opportunity and Spirit was, except a little bit bigger. But no nuclear-powered system like our Mars rovers have. So they're going to land. Well, this is going to land, hopefully, and then start doing science of its own. The problem with their rover over the last 2 years has been the parachutes. Not the problems with their parachutes. They run through tests. They get caught on the door when the door opens up. Ripping parachutes, cutting into the line, that type of thing. So a while back, they figured, let's go talk to NASA. So they're getting help from NASA. NASA is supplying them information on parachutes. We're pretty good at it. We've been able to have pretty large parachutes come down with heavy vehicles such as all the rovers. We had Pathfinder, we had Spirit, we had Opportunity, Mars Curiosity, and now Mars 2020. And their parachute is really big though. I mean, it's 100 feet in diameter. Ours is not that big. We don't need it that big because, when we get closer to the ground, we have
we have the sky crane to slow it down and eventually land the rover on the ground. They don't have that. They're coming down with a heat shield, parachute, and they plan on landing that way. So that's the story on this. Rosalind Franklin, named after a scientist, that's the name of their rover. At least they have a name. We don't have a name for our rover yet. And some school children are supposed to be in the process of picking that name. Did a station make a transmission? I guess not. Cygnus spacecraft should dock tomorrow as well. So I got two things to pay attention to, whether or not the Cygnus gets berthed to the Harmony node of space station, that's the forward node, forward Silma, out of all the different Silmas, or not. They plan on doing that. And to do that yesterday, the day before, they had to make sure that space was open. And they deberthed the HTV. HTV is the cargo vehicle that was sent up by a Japanese rocket, the H-2B, not so long ago, and they attached it to the bottom of the Harmony node, where the same location where the Cygnus spacecraft will attach to tomorrow. So that's pretty much it. I don't have any other topics. If anybody has any questions or comments, I'll be here for that. This is WS2N. I guess we could turn it over to Dick and see what Dick wants to do, and see if he has any comments, questions, or if he wants to turn it over to Roy. And by the way, you should be able to see this picture that I took on that website, roy.ac2gs.com. Go to that, and you'll see his material and mine as well. It's pretty good, you know, to realize that you could see a launch. You know, it's far away, but you could see it from Long Island, and it only happens roughly, I'm not going to say twice a year, but, you know, close to twice a year. You do have another Cygnus launch going up, I think about 6 or 7 months from now. Any comments or questions? If not, we'll turn it over to K2RIW. This is WS2L.
Paul, in that picture, you've got a red arrow that's pointing to what I think is sort of a streak in the sky. Was that the exhaust from the rocket making that streak across the sky, or is that a time-lapse photograph? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that's it. What I do is I zoom in, it's actually hard to see the red arrow, so you zoom in a little bit, you see the red arrow, and then you zoom in and you can see that white line. Yeah, that's it. And then, I mean, a second or two after that, that was gone. So I just happened to hit it right. I tried a couple of pictures before it, but when I checked through them, they didn't have it. Back to you, Dale.
Was that a time exposure, Paul, or is that a 60th of a second? And if it was a 60th of a second, so to speak, what made that white streak? Is that the vapor trail from the rocket? Go ahead.
It's just a Samsung phone, 13 megapixels on the phone, and that's it. I tried a couple of different settings on the phone, you know. But I hit a wrong one. I hit panoramic. That delayed me a few seconds. Because the total time of seeing this was maybe, I don't know, 30 seconds. So I didn't have much of a window to take that picture. What you're looking at are the two RD-181 engines. They're built by Russia. This is the same company. It used to be called Orbital ATK. And they had old Russian engines, Remember the moon rocket that they were going to launch to the moon back in the 60s? They had these NK-33 engines. They had, like, I don't know, 30 of these things at the bottom of the engine, at the bottom of the rocket. They were all supposed to launch together, and they tried this three different times, and every time it blew up, and that was the end of their moon mission. Well, the NK-33 engines, they saved, and they stored, and it wasn't until the early 90s that Aerojet Rocketdyne got the bright idea, well, let's buy these things, and we'll rework them, you know, make it to our specifications here in the States. They renamed them. They called them AJ-26s, and they sold them to Orbital ATK at the time, now Northrop Grumman, and they attached these two engines to the Antares rocket, and they flew a couple of missions. They got two missions off successfully, and then the third one, you know, that they launched to the space station blew up, a quarter of a mile above the pad. It destroyed a lot of stuff on a launch pad. And, they had to regroup, and by regrouping, they started launching Cygnus rockets. But, you know, Boeing helped them out, and they would take the Cygnus and put it onto an Atlas V down in Florida. And, you know, that was the end of Wallops Island for a while for Cygnus and Antares, until they got these new Russian engines called the RD-181s. And they put that on the bottom of the rocket, and that's what they've been using for the last, I think, three or four flights. And now this one's upgraded. Let me drop it. And that's why we're able to see this one so good, this flight. This one is upgraded, stronger intersection, pieces for the, you know, that connect the two, first stage and the second stage together. They've decided to, you know, because it's a stronger vehicle, they decided to let this thing run 100%. You know, when they launch, they're 100%, but then all these vehicles, including the space shuttle, used to throttle down because they were going through something called maximum Q. I know, Dick, you know what maximum Q is, but that's where, when the rocket is going the fastest speed in relation to the atmosphere, so it's the most stress on the vehicle at that point. And then they get above that, and the atmosphere thins out, and then they're able to accelerate, you know, all the way back up to 100%. That's what Antares was doing for all these flights, for 11 flights. This flight number 12, they're going full blast. And by doing that, they were able to, one of the benefits is they could actually put more mass onto the Cygnus cargo vehicle. But Antares now flies, you know, with these two rocket engines for actually a longer period of time. So the older flight, it would cut actually a little bit low, right at where the trees were, where I couldn't see it. I just couldn't see it. I knew where it was, but this one I was able to see because it just came up high enough. If you look at the picture, you can see it's right above the, well, there's trees to the left, trees to the right. It's right in the throat of that. So that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the exhaust, the actual light from the engine itself. It's not too discernible, but, you know, that's the light from the engines and the exhaust. And it's daytime, and, you know, you can see it back there.
The streak from the rocket engine is a long line, or maybe it's two lines, I'm not sure. Is that a kind of a vapor trail that we're seeing, Paul, that was left to... as it went through that portion of space?
It's probably a contrail, you know, a condensation trail to some degree, but it's mostly the exhaust from the RP-1, the rocket propellant one, and the oxygen. Antares runs RP-1, which is kerosene, essentially. It's a refined kerosene, not like the space shuttle. if it was the space shuttle that we were looking at, that would be all, I could tell you, that would be all water vapor, all steam. That was the exhaust. But this is the exhaust from kerosene and oxygen.
Great stuff. So those Russian engines have been reborn, and the oldest one being used, what's your guess as to how many years old, Paul?
Oh, these are new. These are the RD-181s. I think using the name Russia is wrong. They're really Ukraine. They're the ones that build these things. So, Orbital ATK, I'm trying to think of the name. Orbital ATK decided to go this way and replace it with other Russian engines that were approved by the government and NASA to, right now we can't buy any more Russian engines. You can't buy, whatever we have is, that's it we have. We can't get any new ones because we're still launching out of five rockets, which might have a military mission. Once the stock of engines is gone, that's it. That's why Atlas, they're running, they're still running the RD-180s, not the RD-181s. But eventually what's going to happen is Boeing is building a different rocket altogether called the Vulcan, and they're building the Vulcan All-American, including the American engines. Yeah, American engines are being built by Jeff Bezos, Amazon, who owns Blue Origin. Blue Origin is building these rocket engines called the BE-4. And they're going to have two BE-4s at the bottom of the new Vulcan rockets. And eventually the Vulcan rockets will fly people because you're going to have these Starliner vehicles on, mounted on top of that. But Northrop Grumman, they still got the okay for these other Russian engines, the RD-181s. So they'll be launching them for, I think, a good time into the future. I haven't heard when they have to stop, or if they're going to stop doing that.
Slightly different subject. I think there's two separate organizations building spacecraft by which volunteers can go 60 kilometers or 50 miles up and very briefly experience astronaut space flight. As it currently stands, how soon will those operations take place? In other words, if I signed up today, how soon could I become an astronaut by way of this volunteer service? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, probably pretty soon after they shake all the money out of your bank account. I think it's going to be $250,000 plus, something like that. And you'll get a suborbital flight. You'll get up to the Kármán line, which is 100 kilometers up, roughly 62 miles above the ground, a few minutes of weightlessness, and then maybe even unbuckle your seatbelt, do a flip, put yourself back into the seat, and then come back and land. Two companies are Orbital is Blue Origin, which is again the same company building the Blue Origin BE-4 engines for the new Vulcan rocket that Boeing and Lockheed are putting together. That same company, Blue Origin, is building the new Shepard. The new Shepard launches from Texas. We'll put eventually six people on board in their capsule, and you'll be able to launch. It's only got one engine, one stage, one engine. It's they call it a BE-3 engine. BE-3 engine runs on liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. So you'll be able to pay that kind of money, $250,000 to get into space. That might happen. They keep testing them. I mean, they've gone through, I don't know how many different iterations of the new Shepard, I think four now, and they've flown to space like 11 different times, and probably around three, four more test flights. So probably early next year would be the earliest, you're going to see the first, you know, people going to space. First paying people probably 6 months after that, you know. I guess sometimes it may be the fall of next year. One company, the other company is Virgin Galactic, owned by Richard Branson. Again, probably around the same kind of money to get into his space plane, and you get put onto the White Knight carrier plane, which has got these four jet engines, and it's going to bring up to 45,000 feet. They're going to push a button, and then your plane with wings and everything is going to, space plane is going to drop from that. It's going to ignite a hybrid engine, flash up to, again, to the Kármán line, and then come back and land. And that's going to happen in New Mexico, a place called Spaceport America. That's been built for, you know, for, by the taxpayer of New Mexico. They've had a couple of people, you know, to join on, and one of the people is Virgin Galactic. So they're the two companies that can. That might be a little sooner. I think he's going to have his first flight possibly by late December. He's already sent Unity into space with a pilot, co-pilot, and one person in the back. But you want to know when you could pay. A couple of months after that. So, again, probably in the spring would be the earliest of next year. If things go wrong, then, you know, forget it. You know, you're looking at years. But if everything goes right, maybe as early as the spring of next year, is my guess.
$250,000 to go to space for a couple of minutes. If you calculate that in dollars per minute, my goodness, that's expensive. There must be people who have got money they don't know what to do with. What's your guess as to how many people have signed up for either one of these missions, Paul? And have any of them dropped out, or are they still hanging in there and looking forward to their space flight for $250,000?
I know some dropped out in 2012 when the first test plane blew up. He called it Enterprise. That was by Virgin Galactic. And some people dropped out, but then a lot of people didn't. You know, they left their deposit down. And he's got over 600 people signed up for that today. That's what they claim. And then the other guy, Blue Origin, as far as I know, they don't have anybody signed up. So they plan on taking it a little slower. They'll run some tests, you know, put their own astronauts on board and test that out. Probably, that's why I think maybe the earliest this summer. Paying people maybe to fall. He takes things very slow. And with Virgin Galactic, I mean, last Monday he was down at the New York Stock Exchange. He got to ring the bell, for the opening bell. And now you can buy, you know, space stock, I guess. I think what happened was it was an IPO, so. He opened like I don't know, $12 and change or something. He was going up, and then by the end of the day, he was down. So I don't know if everybody's buying into it. You have to wait and see. You know, that's the stock market. You know, good luck with that. Back to you, Nick.
600 people signed up. That's amazing. Okay, we've used up our time. 73, you all. Turn it over to Roy if he wants to repeat his addresses. And we'll see you guys next week. AC2GS, if he's still there, K2RIW.
Sometimes I think, Dick, that I'm always there, but not really. Anyway, once again, if anyone has any mailbag questions for Dick and can't get on the net itself, if they have any space report comments to give Paul, I'll send it to him through my email. And if you have any topics for me, questions or puzzlers or what have you, or you want to refute what I've been saying with reference material, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That's my call sign, mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. www.thepicturethatpaulmentioned.com. Links to the picture that Paul mentioned and to the stories that I gave out today and to the National Geographic article about the coal. You can find it at roy.ac2gs.com. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. And again, in future, if you ever need an audio stream, you can point your web browser at technet.ac2gs.com for an audio stream. So, once again, want to thank everyone who participated tonight and made this an interesting experience for us all, I hope. And, of course, thanks to Paul and thanks to Dick for giving me the opportunity. I wish everyone a good week, and hopefully we'll be back next Sunday with some more stories, and if I can figure something out, a new puzzler. So this is AC2GS, and I'll be going clear now.
Bye-bye, Roy. Bye-bye, Paul. See you guys later. KQRIW clear.
Next week. And that's it. We've got the Club Net, Club Infonet tomorrow on the repeater. So, 73. Go Limox. Go Technet.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. Good morning, the time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater.
Bravo 2, Mike Sierra Bravo Mobile, listening.
WB2MSP, and Tuio, how are you, Maury?
Good morning, Rich. It's very quiet out there. Where is everybody? I don't know. The sun is finally up now. I'm heading out east, and it's not dark, so that's a good thing. It will be dark on the trip back, though, unfortunately, and it's about 44 degrees out here today.
Okay, Maury is getting more toward winter. I get up normally around 5. And I'm glad we're back on Eastern Standard. because, you know, we get the light earlier. It got light, what, about 6 o'clock or a little before, I noticed. So, look, we're coming on to the shortest day of the year, which is December 21st, the winter solstice. But, we got good stuff. We got Thanksgiving, we got Christmas, and New Year's.
Roger, roger. Yeah, looking forward to that. The family used to come out to us in Stony Brook for Thanksgiving for a long time, and then about 15 years ago, they all decided it was too far because most of them live in Jersey. But, so we're heading down to my sister-in-law's. Rich, let me ask you, are you using a new radio or a new microphone or something? It sounds like it's a little overdriven there. What do you think?
I don't know. Maybe I was too close. It's a new microphone. It's a new old microphone that I used for a long time. I'm nasal. I have a congestion. I've been trying to get shake this cold. For nearly 2 weeks. I feel terrible. I feel good now. I just have congestion.
Hey, well, that could be part of it, yeah. Yeah, I usually get a cold sometime in February. I usually get my annual February cold. I'm not looking forward to that. And hopefully things won't be so bad this year. And let's see. What else?
Whoop.
My Waze lady is telling me that I better slow down a little bit. Not too much. Anyway, some CW and some phone contacts. And all in all, it was a nice day out there.
Okay, I missed the beginning. You're overdriving. You're overdriving. And you're cutting out a little repeater.
Okay, yeah, it might have been a little blank. The Waze lady was talking while I was driving, so she might have come through the radio there. I'm just coming up on the William Floyd Parkway now.
Okay, Maury, what are you working in the city or what? You're in Suffolk right now, right?
I was working in Westchester once in a while. I'm heading out to East Hampton now. I go out there a few times a month and do some work out there. And then this weekend I'm heading back up to Vermont to work up there for the weekend, so I'm living the life of a semi-retired guy, and I feel like I'm doing more travel and more work than I did when I was full-time.
Okay, boy. I'm sorry for the delay. I didn't want to cough. What do you do, boy?
Working in an emergency room up in Vermont, a health center that's out in East Hampton that serves the local community, but seems like it's 75-80% Spanish people who are there working. And so I had to dig far back and remember a lot of my Spanish from when I was working in the Bronx, but it seems to be working out okay.
Okay, what kind of work?
Emergency medicine, emergency room.
Okay, so you're an MD.
Yeah, MD. That's me. Mentally deficient. Yep.
Okay. I wouldn't call it mentally deficient. It's 4 years pre-med, 4 years medical school, and then you have to start a practice. It's hardly mentally deficient.
Yeah, but in between the medical school and the practice, we're from 3 to 6 years plus. So it is a long haul. And, you know, I don't know. My scoutmaster told me I should be a teacher. I'm beginning to think that he was right.
All right. By the way, talk softer. You keep cutting out of the repeater or back away. I would have made a good teacher. But I went into electronics because when I was a kid, I was always interested in electronics from the age of 9. I went to high school. I took a lot of shop. They don't have shop anymore, but in high school, junior high, in fact, I used to cut some classes and sneak into the shop because I loved it so much. Teachers probably knew, but they didn't seem